Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Weed Wonks, the podcast that dives deep into the nerdy details, the minutiae, the ever-fun silliness that is cannabis regulatory policy. And we do it all to help our fellow policy wonks, policymakers, regulators, business members, advocates, and the canna curious stay more informed about the ever-changing landscape of cannabis laws and regulations. Please remember to rate, subscribe, and review. I'm your host, Jordan Wellington, managing partner at VS Strategies. As always, we want to give thanks to our amazing sponsors, Rootworks, and our wonderful producer, Josh. Today, we have a fun show for you guys. I cannot tell you how excited I am about this because we have someone from my home state, the great state of New Jersey, the underappreciated state of New Jersey, with beautiful beaches and amazing cities and wonderful people that sometimes gets looked over in the great distance between New York and Philadelphia. And I cannot tell you how excited I am to talk about my home state. If you want to know why I can't stop cursing and why I always talk with my hands, it's because I'm from New Jersey and that's how we are where I grew up. And today we have an amazing guest. We have Jeff Brown, the executive director of the Cannabis Regulatory Commission in my great home state of New Jersey. Jeff, I'm so happy to welcome you to the Weed Wonks.
Thank you for having me, Jordan. I'm very excited to be here.
Great. Well, as we get started, as we always like to do with new guests, I'd love to talk a little bit about your background, how you got started in policy and regulation, in a way that will give us a chance to understand your perspective as you come into your role as a cannabis regulator.
Yeah. So I guess there's not really a traditional route into cannabis policy. I came from healthcare policy. I started as, you know, in the beginning of my career, working on political campaigns. I was always motivated by healthcare policy. And after a couple of years on political campaigns, transitioned to focus on implementing the Affordable Care Act, working on Medicaid reform, and ultimately a focus on, healthcare for low income, individuals, either through Medicaid, Medicare. And I was doing that for several years at nonprofits, a policy think tank, and then ultimately an association for safety net hospitals. And when Governor Murphy was elected, I was very interested in getting into public service. And I was having conversations with friends of mine, former colleagues who were accepting jobs with the administration. One of the places I was looking was the Department of Health, and there were a couple different positions there. And my friend and former colleague, Jackie Cornell, was hired as the deputy commissioner at the Department of Health. I'd been through a number of interviews, and one day she called me and she said, "Hey, what do you think about assistant commissioner for medicinal marijuana?" And, I was kind of like, "Huh, I haven't really thought anything about that before, but let me think about it." And, I called a couple people who I consider to be career mentors and asked their advice. And universally, they were like, "You got to take that job." I called my mom and she said, "When it comes to drugs, just say no." but she was half joking, and she ultimately voted for the legalization ballot initiative. So, that's really how I came in. I came from healthcare policy, and I was brought in. My first day was the day that we announced what was the Executive Order 6 report. So Governor Murphy, his sixth executive order was about expanding access to medicinal cannabis. And my first day was at the press conference that the Department of Health had to unveil the recommendations and the policy actions that we were going to take to do that. From there on, I was handed the report and told, my job was to get it done. And so, we worked that. We updated our regs. We dropped fees for patients. We, expanded the market and ultimately went from 17,000 patients to 130,000 patients at our high point.
Yeah, that's awesome. I love your story about how someone suggested you do that and you were like, "Oh my God, am I going to really do this?" Because it just feels so similar to when I was asked to run implementation of adult use cannabis in Colorado. And I said to the legislative director, like, could you please do something else? And he's also a Jersey guy. So he said, "Fuck no, go do what I told you," which for people who's not like it, that is polite in New Jersey. That's not being
that is polite. Yeah,
that's being that is very polite. Respectful. Like, but it's just very funny because my immediate reaction was, "Oh my God, like, what is this going to do to my career?" And it sounds like you had the same immediate reaction. I was excited. I wanted to do it, but I was like, young and had plenty of law school debt and, you know, working at the Office of Legislative Services in New Jersey doesn't exactly help you pay off that stuff, which was my first gig out of law school. So I was like a little scared. And, you know, turned out to be the most wonderful thing that ever happened to me in my life outside of my wife and my kid. But, you know, it's just so funny to hear you say that because I had kind of the same thing. And then when I talked to all of my people, I was like, yes, this is going to be awesome. And then the other thing that you mentioned that I think before we get into anything else, I want to highlight is you mentioned an absolutely amazing person who has done not only awesome stuff in cannabis, but amazing stuff in healthcare policy and healthcare access. And that is the incomparable Jackie Cornell. And so I love giving shout outs to great people on the podcast. And Jackie is just an amazing human being. And I took my chance. You want to take a chance to say something nice about Jackie before we move
Absolutely.
On?
Absolutely. So Jackie and I have worked together a number of times. First time was on Corzine's reelection campaign. We worked together on at Organizing for America and then ultimately, you know, at the Department of Health. Jackie is phenomenal. You know, she crushes everything that she does. And, you know, she's now the executive director of Planned Parenthood in New Jersey. And, you know, I'm not involved in elections in any way, shape, or form anymore. But they, you know, I think abortion and abortion rights seem to have played a pretty significant role in the results that we just saw in New Jersey. So, all good things to say about Jackie. She's an amazing person. And, you know, I think the world's better for having her in it.
Well, that's awesome. I've gotten to meet Jackie over the years and worked with her a little bit. And it was just an amazing, amazing experience. She's a powerful and wonderful person and does so much good in the world. So I always love having those mutual connections with people. And, you know, as we kind of shift into the substantive conversation, I think one of the interesting things that will allow us to kind of weave our way through these conversations is you are someone who is able to come in and be a medical regulator, run the medical program, not technically from its start, but from its real start, if you will. Like, it wasn't really the most functional thing in the world before that. So it's more or less from its start into a use as into a role as an adult use regulator. And I think that that's such an important and interesting transition because not all of the adult use regulators that we get to talk to on the podcast got to run the medical program and work through the transition. Some folks just came in, you know, and I've focused on being an adult use regulator, and that's such an important shift in focus. And so I definitely want to mention that. And so now you're in charge of both a medical and an adult use program. And so as you come into that program, how do you feel the shift in focus of the organization, shift in structure has, you know, kind of evolved your job, evolved the program, and I'm sure in many ways for the better?
Yeah. So, you know, just to give you a snapshot for where New Jersey was when I came in and at the beginning of 2018, the program had existed. It was signed into law in 2010. I think the first dispensary opened its doors at the very end of 2012. And then there were four more dispensaries that opened up between the end of 2012 and when I came in at the beginning of 2018. So we had 17,000 patients and a grand total of five dispensaries throughout the state. Part of the initiatives that we did under the Department of Health was to immediately expand the conditions by which someone could qualify for medicinal cannabis. And I think the two big ads were chronic pain and anxiety. You know, I think upwards of 20% of the population could be affected by either of those conditions. And so, you know, with those additions and cutting fees, we saw immediate, you know, expansion of the patient roles. I think the critical challenges with, you know, with when I came in are vastly different from sort of the charge that I've now come to have, you know, being a regulator of both adult use and recreational. And in those early days, it was, you know, strictly focused on patient access, you know, getting into the program, getting enrolled. And then once you're enrolled, getting access to a dispensary and you know, having access to a wide range of products. And so
just real quick, I think it's important to highlight, you know, what you guys were doing there, especially with the conditions. I mean, first of all, people might not know this. New Jersey is not the biggest state in the world. So people might be like, oh, five dispensaries. Everyone's going to be like a half an hour away, 20 minutes away. No. New Jersey is the most densely populated state in the entire country. And anything that is more than two or three towns away is almost 45 minutes in traffic sometimes. So having good coverage is different in a densely populated state than a more rural state. And the conditions that you added are so key to patient access. And I think this is something that folks miss. A lot of times you have a list of conditions. Most of those conditions are typically diseases. So you have to have a specific disease to qualify. The two you listed, anxiety and chronic pain, those are symptoms, right, of many, 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 many diseases. And so it's so important when you think about a medical cannabis program to not just list specific diseases that cannabis can help, but also conditions that cannabis can help with, so that you're not restricting access to just a specific and limited group of diseases. You can actually, by listing a condition, give access and palliative care to so many people, because it doesn't matter what your underlying condition is. The fact that your symptoms include chronic pain mean that cannabis can be a much more palliative benefit than opiates and other things that people use to treat chronic pain.
That's exactly right. And you know, to give you a couple examples of that, you know, with anxiety, like there was a lot of interest from the autism community around around cannabis, because there was some research out of Israel that showed that I think CBD specifically could really help out. And you know, while autism wasn't listed as a condition, individuals who have autism can experience high levels of anxiety. And so, you know, it's that anxiety condition or symptom that, you know, individuals could qualify under. Similarly, with chronic pain, there are a number of medical conditions that result in chronic pain. And so when we had a review panel and when they listed chronic pain, there were like, you know, 25 conditions listed under chronic pain that resulted in chronic pain. And so, you know, that enabled us to advise physicians, yeah, you know, this specific condition might not be on the list, but if it results in chronic pain and you deem the person as chronic pain, then they can, you know, legally be admitted into the program.
And then you can suggest they try cannabis before they try like synthetic opiate derivatives, which are really
exactly cool. And I'm glad you mentioned, you know, synthetic opioid derivatives, because one of the things that the review panel specifically called out was that cannabis might be helpful in opioid use disorder, because actually withdrawal from opioids results in pain. And we issued a clarifying final agency decision shortly after, you know, adding chronic pain and anxiety, to note that treatment for opioid use disorder, it can be included in there. And so I think New Jersey and I believe it was Pennsylvania, where maybe there were a couple other states, were some of the first states that, you know, made cannabis available as part of a, you know, a potential drug treatment regimen, you know, almost like a new form of medication assisted therapy.
Yeah. In Colorado, when we added opiates, there was some kerfuffle about what was going to be added. It took an extra year that I don't want to get into. But the second time around, we kind of tinkered with the language, and I came up with the idea of, why don't we draft it as any condition for which an opiate could be prescribed? So instead of saying for chronic pain, or, you know, kind of like loosely getting in there, we made it very clear. And instead of, you know, a lot of other versions of the language, it's anything that you could prescribe an opiate for, now you can prescribe cannabis, which I think opened up a lot of doors and didn't kind of require, again, that same idea. And just a quick mention, I love that you also mentioned autism, because that's a big one. Big shout out to Michelle Walker, a huge patient advocate out in Colorado. We recorded a show with her a while back that I'm sure you can find in the feed about her journey with her son, and how she's found so much treatment, not just for all of the other conditions, but how by treating other conditions with cannabis is kind of how she discovered that cannabis actually had a really big impact on autism. And again, multi-year journey to get autism added to the list of conditions here in Colorado, but a particularly gnarly 2-year process that when Governor Polis came in, he was like, get that bill to my desk. And, you know, a lot of people worked really hard and did. And so that was an awesome moment. And so now, what are the other aspects of, as you transition from medical and this patient-centered focus and maximizing patient access, and now you still have a mission of patient access, right? Because New Jersey still has a medical program. That mission doesn't go away, and that mission is always so important and should stay at the core of any cannabis program. But now you have a new mission, you have new goals and new structures that have come in. So what are the other things that you've seen that have changed since you've added adult use in terms of how you're looking at things?
So I do want to mention, you know, digging out of the Christie era hole, you know, really continued into the adult use implementation phase. And, you know, we expanded patient enrollment, but, you know, expanding the industry took took longer. You know, we issued an RFA in 2018 to double the number of dispensaries, and they were all vertically integrated because we didn't have an opportunity to go through the full rulemaking process prior to doing that. And then we issued a second one in 2019. You know, that one ultimately got a temporary stay in court because of some technical issues that we ultimately won on. But just because of that delay, when we launched, you know, I'd say fast forward to the end of 2020 when we're passing adult use legislation. I think we had 24 dispensaries statewide at that point. You know, 24 dispensaries for, at that time, 130,000 patients. We probably needed a few more dispensaries for the patients alone.
Just a
couple. And then you're talking about the prospect of adding, you know, potentially, I don't know, 10-15% of the population as far as, you know, adult use consumers. You know, we knew that we had to keep the focus on patients in that transition. But we also had to immediately look to, you know, really standing up the new adult use industry. And so we made a couple decisions. You know, number one is outside of doing the initial rules, which, you know, we had to do in basically, you know, 6 months from the time the law was passed, and not something I ever want to relive ever again in my life.
Same, we
had the deadline, but you know, I'm good on that one. I think I responded to a Cannabis Regulators Association survey. You know, they asked advice for regulators facing the same thing, and I was like, apologize to your family in advance.
I remember those 6 months that we had in Colorado too, and it was we were busy. A lot of late nights having dinner with your colleagues, not being at home. But a lot of good jokes came out of that time too. A lot of funny jokes that we referenced to each other still to this day.
Yeah, I mean, it's something, you know, again, it's not many people get to go through it, you know, but once you do it, you know, it's a feat. We knew we had to get licensing of new businesses up and going as quickly as possible. And that's because just an infrastructure of 24 medicinal dispensaries would not suffice. And so the first thing that the commission did, because we went from being under the Department of Health, a division within a state agency, to being a semi-independent commission, was to finish up the request for applications that was issued in 2019, issue, I think, 30 dispensary permit awards, 10 cultivation permit awards, as well as 4 vertically integrated permit awards. So those were done at the end of 21. Also at the end of 21, we actually opened up licensing for new cannabis businesses to get new folks going in the pipeline. And one of the big transition points when we went from we started in medical, you know, under medical, we had some equity provisions. So, for example, we added scoring in those RFAs based on, you know, whether you were a certified minority, women owned or veteran owned business. But in adult use, we knew that we needed a focus on social equity from day one. We knew that had to be core to the licensing process. I also knew that having lived the limited license market life for several years, that we wanted to leave that behind and move to, you know, a market-based rolling application process that prioritizes equity. But, you know, stakeholder expectations also shift considerably in that transition. You know, when we were medical only, most of the stakeholder expectations were really around medical access. It was around price of medicine. It was around, you know, making sure there were dispensaries close by, making sure that you had the products you need. And, you know, in the expansion to adult use, the number one, the breadth of stakeholders increases. There's a lot more people that care, for better or worse, you know, both pro and con, when you're launching adult use cannabis. And the focus changes. The focus then becomes about, you know, getting businesses licensed, getting, you know, getting sales started and, you know, things of that nature. And so, you know, we had some challenges to contend with, and, you know, it's only now, you know, in 2023 that we're, you know, we're upwards, I think we're at about 80 dispensaries statewide, and we've really gotten this to, you know, we're not fully fleshed out, but we're on the path to being a fully operational market.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that people should, when you think about this kind of development and growth of licenses, there's stuff that's outside of your control too, right? Getting sales started, getting businesses open. There's the licensing part. There's the creating regulations part that you can do in 6 months. But anybody that's from or been or lived in and done business in New Jersey will tell you, getting the idea and picking your spot where you want to start your business and getting a license, that's one thing. But getting through the process of getting something built out and approved by local governments and open to customers in Jersey, that is another process. And if you think government and rulemaking takes a long time, opening up a business in Jersey, that also takes a long time. So you've got to kind of, you kind of navigate both the stuff that's in your control, but also the stuff that's not in your control. And so I think, you know, the fact that you've gotten so far is a huge testament to a lot of hard work by a lot of state and local regulators. But there's also obviously a lot of time to come in the future that we're going to be excited to see in the market rollout. On the regulatory side of things, you also had an interesting transition that I think most folks haven't experienced. And I'd love to just talk about it for a minute. I don't want to get too waylaid, but there are very few regulators that have run any type, forget cannabis, any type of program as an independent regulatory agency. And then as part of this kind of shift, had a board come in and gone from a board-less regulatory agency to a board-driven regulatory agency. And I'm sure there's been a lot of great stuff that's come out of that and more feedback and folks who've been involved. I've talked to some of the commissioners in New Jersey and they're absolutely fantastic. But can you just talk for a minute from the perspective of a regulator who's running an agency, transitioning from operating without a board to operating within a board, and how has that experience been for you? And I'm sure many positives have come out of it.
Yeah. So, you know, I had to learn, you know, kind of state government first. In a state agency is a division within a state agency. And then I had to learn a whole new form of state government, which was having a board, being a semi-independent commission. The reason it was set up that way in New Jersey is because the state has had experience with that. And legislators look to the Casino Control Commission. New Jersey was, you know, one of the first states to legalize gaming, created a commission to oversee that. And so the idea was to do the same thing here for cannabis, create an independent commission in but not of the Department of Treasury to really do that. And, huge credit to the chair, Diana Wainu. You know, in the early days, it was sort of me and her. We were writing the resolutions. We were getting ready for the meetings. The other commissioners were chipping in. But it was a transition. One of the huge positives was just, you know, doing stuff doing the business of the commission in the public. You know, I think that, under the Department of Health, stuff becomes public when you issue a final agency decision, or if there's, opportunities, structured opportunities for stakeholder engagement. And obviously some of that happens on a daily basis, but, so we would do an RFA and then you'd issue the licenses and, there's not really much engagement other than, sort of the issuing of the decisions and then, any fallout that comes after that. At the commission, all of that is happening in public meetings. I do think that helps instill confidence in the public, that they can show up at a meeting, they can speak their mind, they can, hear the decisions being made, they can watch it on YouTube. I think that has been very important through the first several years of the market. I also think that, it gave us a structured forum to get stakeholder feedback. As part of the Administrative Procedures Act, you have to get stakeholder feedback. We were doing emergency rules. So, we had the ability to do those initial rules without public comment and without going through the full APA process. But nonetheless, we wanted to get stakeholder feedback. And so by, having commission meetings monthly, and in the early days, we were doing them every 2 weeks, which is another thing I don't want to relive, we were able to get a lot of stakeholder feedback in a very structured way. It enabled us to get real-time data from stakeholders that we could then sort of take and put right into the rulemaking that was going on behind the scenes. And then when the rules were released, it's not like they were just released, and appeared in the register, and then everyone had to look through them. You know, we had a public meeting. I walked through all the provisions that were in the rules. You know, we walked through all the major pieces, and then they were published. So I think doing everything in the public was immensely helpful for us as an agency. I also think it was immensely helpful for the stakeholders who wanted to engage with the commission and wanted to engage with the process, because it gave them a way to do that. I will say that there's just, you know, there are things that you have to change when you're an independent commission versus when you're part of a state agency. We've been fortunate enough to have some great state partners. So like, I mentioned that because, you know, eventually, like, we're going to have all, you know, our own HR, our own IT and stuff like that. But we were able to, in the early days, you know, work with our Office of Information Technology to, you know, help stand up critical systems, work with Department of Treasury's human resources to onboard employees. But, you know, it was a transition. It's a different form of government. You know, I think there's pluses and minuses to both, but I think it really helped us to craft, you know, craft effective rules and get stakeholder engagement in that process, so that what was ultimately put out there was accepted by the, you know, stakeholders, and we were able to move forward with.
Yeah. And I think when you're creating regulations, even tinkering with them in time or implementing, there's nothing like stakeholder feedback. There's nothing like stakeholder conversations. There's nothing like stakeholders debating among themselves. That's always when I was back at the state, one of my favorite things is you kind of like almost structure a stakeholder meeting where you know you're going to create an argument between a couple of different groups of people. But that's how you learn, right? You listen to them argue, you listen to their points, you understand where each of them are coming from, and then you can make the right policy decision based on kind of triangulating all those different points of interest. One of the other things that you've been able to do and really been focusing on with adult use is investing in data infrastructure. So I know there's a bunch of stuff that we want to talk about, and we're already a ways in, but I think, you know, obviously policy decisions made by data-driven kind of thinking and influencing and learning from are really important as we continue to evolve and make cannabis regulations better. So you can talk a little bit about the investments that you're making on data infrastructure.
Yeah. So when we set up the structure of the commission, and we set up different offices, you know, Office of Compliance and Investigations, Office of Licensing, Office of Diversity and Inclusion, which is included in the statute. I knew from day one that we needed to invest in data and the ability to analyze data and report out data. And so we created an Office of Data and Business Analytics. You know, because of that investment, you know, we're able to take licensing data, we're able to take inventory data, we're able to take, you know, data from our cannabis business or ATC identification cards or registry data, and we can kind of, you know, put it all together and look at, you know, internal performance. We can report out to external stakeholders how we're doing. You know, mentioned social equity and the focus there. Every quarter, for the most part, we've had some busy quarters where we missed it, but for the most part, every quarter we're releasing data on demographics of majority owners of cannabis businesses in the state of New Jersey. We're releasing data on the number of minority-owned businesses that have been licensed, and the number of women-owned businesses, and the number of disabled veteran-owned businesses. We're releasing data on the demographic, makeup of the employees who work at these businesses. It's really important that everybody sees this market developing, in real time through that process, because it's you know, whether you're state legislators or advocates, that having a diverse market is a shared goal by most people who are paying attention in New Jersey. And so we knew we needed to be able to report out on progress. And so the Office of Data and Business Analytics helps us do that. You know, internally, it enables us to look at sort of key metrics in the market. You know, we can the stuff we're reporting out, you know, right now we're looking at stuff like price and, total sales. But, we're also looking at product mix and eventually when the market's more fully developed, we'll be able to look at that stuff on a, you know, county by county, town by town level and get some important insights from it.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the best parts of when you kind of have a public collection data arm like that, that it's not being done by a private business that's holding that data to their chest and then selling it out to people who can afford to buy it, right? You have essentially democratized business analytics in some way, which can be really cool for especially small businesses that want to be able to access that information, but might not be able to include it in their initial startup costs. But you guys aren't charging. You're just pushing out as much data as you can. And people can use that to make better policy. They can also use it to make better business decisions. And I think that that's, you know, kind of an awesome ancillary benefit to what you're doing as well. They use it to evaluate the program for sure. But if I was a small entrepreneur in the New Jersey cannabis market, that would be a huge value add to my business decision making and my thought process. And so I think that's, you know, talk about prioritizing social equity applicants. You know, I think that that's a great kind of maybe segue to the next topic of like what you guys are doing around social equity applicants, because that may not have been the intention, but I would think that, you know, that is huge value add to the social equity applicants in New Jersey, because it's giving them access to stuff that might cost, you know, tens of thousands of dollars a year that they don't need to put into their business plan as creating another barrier to entry to be competitive. They can actually kind of avoid that cost. You know, and you probably are going to get better data in certain cases when you can buy it, but at least they can get some data to make decisions. And then as their business grows and they're more successful and they have kind of a fatter bottom line, they can use it to kind of fund those things. So you mentioned a couple of times, you know, prioritizing social equity has been a major component of one of your tenets and goals. So what is the state doing to kind of reduce barriers to entry for social equity applicants in the great state of New Jersey?
So the core to that is our licensing process. And in establishing the licensing process, there were a couple important principles. You know, number one, we wanted to move away from a limited license framework. It was, you know, having worked under, you know, statute and regulations that put that forth under medicinal, we really wanted to provide more sort of market-based access to businesses. And we wanted to make sure that, you know, consumers at the end of the day were driving, you know, success in the market and making determinations over who's successful or who's not. But, you know, and so that's kind of geared yields a rolling licensure process where, you know, people are applying and being reviewed as they apply. But something like that isn't, you know, in itself going to be equitable, because, you know, the more well-capitalized companies, you know, are going to have an advantage to get applications in sooner. They'll get reviewed sooner. So one of the things we did was we developed this prioritization matrix, if you will. And part of it was also trying to deal with the puzzle that was handed to us that was in the law as far as, you know, different license types, set asides for every different license type in the law, and trying to meet those quotas that are prescribed in statute. But
in typical New Jersey fashion, it was a prescriptive statute.
It was it is a prescriptive statute. Absolutely. I told our regulatory officer actually today that I was going to get him a shirt that says the statute made me do it.
I think we need to get that for every regulatory agency around the country. That could be Canberra's new fundraising effort. We'll have to talk to Jillian about that one. That is hysterical. That's a great idea.
So, you know, the first thing we did was we created a social equity business designation. There wasn't one in statute. The statutory provisions were really around prioritizing minority owned businesses, but had nothing about past criminal record. You know, had nothing about, you know, it had some stuff about living in impact zones, but that's the definition of impact zone is far too expansive to really, you know, target effectively. And so we created a social equity business designation, and you can qualify two ways. Number one, you know, past criminal history, past, you know, marijuana arrests, convictions, or, you know, be a resident or have been a resident of an economically disadvantaged area. That's a zip code with, you know, lower than average median income, higher than average rates of uninsurance when it comes to healthcare. So that's the core. And those, if you qualify for that, you get reviewed before anybody else in our licensure process. And so, you know, we sort based on two things. Number one, when time you submit, then also that priority designation. So if there's a, you know, social equity business and a non-social equity business that submit at the same time, that social equity business will get reviewed first. If there's a, you know, a business waiting in queue that submitted, you know, a week ago, and then a social equity business submits today, that social equity business is going to jump in front of that that bit other application that doesn't qualify for a priority designation. We also prioritize diversely owned businesses. Those are minority owned businesses, as well as impact zone businesses, which are what are created. That's what was created by statute.
And those are the businesses that are located in an impact zone, not necessarily yes. the reverse of that, which also is part of social equity policies. People who grew up and lived in impact zones over a period of time. Yeah. It's a dual thing, right? You want to empower people who grew up in marginalized communities, but you also want to create business and job opportunities in marginalized communities. And so you kind of, you know, want to look at that issue on both sides.
Yeah. And the reason we created the economically disadvantaged areas, because the impact zone definition was far too expansive. And you're from New Jersey. So for example, Morristown in North Jersey qualified as an impact zone. Morristown is...
It's not a pretty dope place. It's a pretty cool spot, but I don't think of it as like, man, we got to really get jobs into Morristown.
Exactly. Right. So that's why we did the economically disadvantaged area, which is more focused at areas that actually, need additional opportunities. So that's really the priority matrix, and it's been working. About a quarter of all license awards have gone to social equity businesses. Two thirds have gone to diversely owned businesses. I think of majority owners, just under 18% are African American. I think 8% of majority owners are Hispanic or Latino. So we're making really good progress. Entrepreneurs are running into barriers in the market. So we're also partnering with state partners. One is access to capital. And so the New Jersey Economic Development Authority over the summer, they released what's called their seed equity grant program. So they had grants of either $150,000 or $250,000 that went to both social equity businesses and diversely owned businesses to help them, get operational. It's hugely helpful for the 50 or so applicants that qualified for those, and they have more rounds of those coming. And then we're standing up a technical assistance program for anybody who wants to get into the cannabis industry. It'll be free through New Jersey's Business Action Center, and we expect that to launch in early 2024.
Yeah, and I just love so many aspects of what you just talked about. I want to highlight a few of them. First of all, the non-limited license, but prioritization, that like dance, it's so artful, but it is really the best pathway forward, right? You've embraced the free market, but you have created controls to kind of, a little bit engineer the outcomes you're looking for out of that free market without necessarily kind of trying to control everything, which is just, it just never works, right? Like time and time again, it doesn't work. There's all these problems with it. But so you tried to strike a balance, right? It's not pure free market, but it is a market. It is a free market that is not limited and controlled by the state. But social equity applicants have prioritization, and that structure seems to have allowed the market to develop. But also, you just outlined the statistics that it's actually working, but it's working within a framework that actually makes sense in how we structure economies and markets in the United States. So I absolutely love that one. Back when I was way, way, way in the way back machine, I was a bill drafter. It was my first job out of college in New Jersey. So all these names these agencies that you're talking about are just hitting down, because I was actually a bill drafter in the authorities division under Don Margeson, who's an OG name that very few people probably remember, but an amazing, amazing mentor of mine in my early career. And I got that job when I got out of law school. I actually started, I was the bill drafter there from 2010 to 2012. And that was during the last big market contraction, the banking crisis and real estate crisis that had gone on. And so every bill was jobs. Every bill was jobs, and every bill that I wrote, it had to have jobs components, and that's what everyone was talking about. And it always talked about the EDA and the New Jersey Business Action Center. And New Jersey, for those who don't know, has one of the most thoughtful and like kind of well structured economic development programs that I kind of encountered. Like, it's just it's an awesome thing that's kind of baked into the way the state has operated. And it's really cool to be able to tap into those amazing resources that have been created for other markets, because at the end of the day, a lot of times cannabis is just a widget, right? Like, economic development is economic development, and reaching into those areas and saying, okay, cool, you guys are really good at grants and giving out grants. you guys help us with this. You guys are the ones who are doing this. In Colorado, we've done that. Our Office of Economic Development and International Trade is giving out grants to social equity businesses, not the Colorado Marijuana Enforcement Division, because that's not what they do. It's leveraging those things and kind of the concept of cannabis is just a widget. It's a really special widget, but the magic's in the plant, not in the regulations. And like, that's a really awesome concept. And I love the fact that you're talking about, you know, giving out grants, right? If that's one of the core things. If you qualify for social equity, that you probably need capital, right? Like that's, those two things are most likely married together. That's the whole point of this. And so making sure you can bridge that gap and that they don't have to go to the private markets for their initial round of financing that'll suck up all the equity and other things out of that business. And then you mentioned technical assistance programs, obviously, are also super important. Can you talk a little bit more about that? That one got like a little bit short at the end. And I think there's some really cool stuff going on in New Jersey around that.
Yeah. So our Business Action Center, and they provide free assistance to, you know, anybody in the state who wants to start a business. You can go to their website, you know, you can find out, it'll link you to everything that you need to do from registering your business to, you know, filing your formation papers, you know, whether you qualify for a minority owned business certificate. They help you navigate all those things. And so we worked with them to, number one, add cannabis businesses to their business navigator program. So that's kind of what I just explained. You know, somebody goes there, say, I want to start a cannabis business. They can sort of click through and it'll tell them exactly what they need to do. It'll ultimately click through to our licensing page. But more importantly, they are establishing a robust technical assistance program free. It's targeted at people who live in impact zones or want to locate in impact zones or want to hire from impact zones. But they're putting together a full curriculum, you know, to help entrepreneurs succeed. And I think it's, you know, everything from how to start a business to how to get financing to, you know, how to comply with the New Jersey CRC's rules, how to navigate our licensing process, how to make sure you come out successful at the end, how to navigate the local process. They're recruiting teachers. They're, you know, once they launch, it's going to be phenomenal. We've worked with them hand in hand along the way. And our director of our Office of Diversity and Inclusion, Wesley McWhite, he's engaged with actual legacy operators from around the country who want to transition to the legal market, or at least wanted to provide feedback on what a state should do to get legacy operators to transition to a legal market. And that's going to, you know, that stakeholdering, which has been really important. And I want to give a shout out to an advocate named Leo Bridgewater, because he's been instrumental he's from New Jersey. He's a veteran. He's been instrumental in kind of helping us forge some connections. Through that work, we've been able to get stakeholder feedback from a group that, you know, is kind of left out in a lot of cases. And unless they speak up, you know, regulators aren't hearing from them. And we've been able to incorporate that not only into what we do at the CRC as we craft our regulations, but help the Business Action Center develop kind of a legacy to legal framework as part of their technical assistance program, which is probably one of the most exciting facets of that program that at least for me.
Yeah, and quite frankly, they're super fun. The Color of Cannabis, an organization here in Colorado, and who runs it, Sarah Woodson, amazing person, unbelievable social equity advocate, has taught those, has put on kind of business incubator programs, and I've had the privilege of teaching. The policy of pot is the first teacher of like the history of how we got here and the background and changing laws over years and years and years. And not only is it really an important thing, but of all some of the volunteer experience I've done in my life, one of the most fun, because the engagement that you can have with just the energy and the passion of those people who want to get in the industry and going back and forth about all this stuff. And it's usually just an absolute blast to volunteer and be a part of. If anyone's thinking about doing it, just tremendously engaging. People are excited, gregarious, very fun. And I always have, you know, Saturday morning and I wake up and I'm like, usually on a Saturday morning, if you're waking up and you got to deal with like a work related thing, it's not like motivating and exciting. Those Saturday mornings were always just great. So, you know, shout out to folks who are building those programs, but also call to action for folks who could volunteer and help there, because it really is tremendously fulfilling.
Absolutely. And I just want to mention, you know, one thing that kind of came out of that, we got some questions as part of that process about kind of nurseries, right? Like cannabis cultivators who are focused on cultivating genetics and, you know, helping, you know, other businesses, you know, get genetics and you know, establish new cultivate, you know, new strains, et cetera. And, you know, we looked at our own rules and we recognized that micro businesses, which are meant to be very small businesses, they have a cap of 1,000 mature plants, but there's no cap on immature plants. And so, you know, a real interesting business model is allowable under our rules for a micro business cultivator. And you can transfer immature plants between cultivators. Is that kind of nursery model, you know, focus on cultivating, you know, unique genetics and selling those to other cultivators.
Yeah, or even just starter plants. I mean, it's one of the interesting things about cannabis. It's like one of my favorite things are like, where does the cannabis industry operate differently than other relevant, you know, kind of similar industries? And in most agriculture, you know, breeding and genetics and like is one business and that's what they do. And then another business actually grows the plants, right? Like in cannabis, it's all done in-house. You know, you have your moms, you clone, like it's the cycle that goes on in one business. But in a lot of other agricultural industries, those are two separate businesses doing those functions. And so you could be the, you know, you could be a genetics library and never grow a plant. In California, that's more common. You have folks who focus on breeding those things. And those people are rarely ever actually growing a plant out to flower. Their business is having really good genetics and selling immature plants, you know, seeds or clones to other businesses whose job it is to grow out. And that like kind of specialization is also very, very interesting. So it's super cool that, you know, you're kind of able to start doing that in New Jersey. So pivoting away from the social equity one, the last thing I think we'll probably have time for, maybe we can squeeze a couple quick hitters in at the end, but New Jersey is currently, as we're recording, going through a regulatory development about edible products. And it would kind of feel silly to not talk about the active rulemaking that's going on when we talk about policy in New Jersey. So what exactly is New Jersey doing in terms of the changing in regulations and market expansion around edible products?
So we just announced back in, I believe it was October, an expansion of edible products in the adult use market and in medicinal. We accomplished this through a couple of regulatory waivers, which were effective immediately, and then a full rule proposal, which is making its way through public comment period and will be adopted in the future. But what these will do is they'll, you know, dramatically expand the options that manufacturers have to produce edible products. And I think going back to where we started in this discussion, the reason why it wasn't part of the original rules harkens back to, I think, some you know, things that happened before my time, you know, under the Christie era. The original statutes in New Jersey actually prohibited when the Compassionate Use Act was passed, there were no edibles. And a law was passed after that that allowed edibles only for kids. And so when I came in, the only edible products in New Jersey, you know, they were restricted to kids. We did have some sort of pills and tablets and lozenges that could be available for adults as well. But sort of those traditional edibles were limited to children who qualified for medicinal cannabis, obviously. With Jay Koenig's law, that expanded edibles in the medicinal market. And that passed in the summer of 2019. We did not have an opportunity to do full regulations for Jay Koenig's law because early 2020 COVID hit. Working at the Department of Health, pretty much everybody was deployed, you know, on COVID response, including myself. And when we were implementing adult use, we did not have fully fleshed out edible regulations in medicinal. What we did allow after Jay Koenig's law passed was gummies, which to deal with what our regs had on the books at the time. They were called soft lozenges. And that was really just an artifact from the fact that our regs authorized lozenges, but they didn't authorize gummies.
All right. Before we move on, I just want to like shout out and kudos. One of my favorite things in policy is, you know, okay, how do I fit this in? I'm just going to kind of like fudge it a little bit. We're going to call gummies soft lozenges. And then all of a sudden it fits and it works. And I just, those are some of my favorite things. It's just like problem solving within a confining regulatory structure by using goofy language is always one of the funniest things around. And so well
absolutely.
Done.
Absolutely. And, you know, I remember we got the product proposal and they said it's a soft lozenge. And, you know, I looked at the updated statutes and I went, well, these are authorized now, you know, let's go for it. Let's do it.
Yeah. Fire away. Right. Like it's just funny how like sometimes like logical good policy can be, you know, unintentionally prohibited by prescriptive statutes. And then you just kind of, everyone's okay with it. And you just kind of like find a linguistic solution to kind of how you're going to fix those things. And it's, you know, it's just creative policymaking, which is always, you know, a great fun thing to be able to do when you've got the gig.
Yeah. And so when we transitioned to adult use, we had gummies, you know, soft lozenges. So we did have edibles from day one, and we had, you know, tinctures and drops and some of those other things that were prevalent in the medicinal market. But we didn't have things like brownies or chocolates or, you know, some of those other shelf stable goods. And one of the key, I think, barriers from a regulatory standpoint was we have a regulation, and this is proposed to be updated in these new edible regs that restricted medical ingredients in manufactured medical products to ingredients that are on FDA's database for inactive ingredients. And so, you know, you can find stuff on there like sucrose. You can find a lot of ingredients on there, but a lot of the ingredients that are just used in, you know, in baking or food, beverages, you know, you may not find those on there. So I think a key regulatory update was just expanding the allowable ingredients to include FDA GRAS or FDA generally recognized as safe. Additionally, you know, we have strong manufacturing regulations overall. We require quality control. We require, you know, testing along the process, obviously third-party testing at the end of it. But our edible regs also do include reference to good manufacturing practice regulations. And that's something we intend, you know, that's a place we intend to move the market in the future. But these edible regs, they'll, you know, there are already caramels and chocolates on the market. We expect to see, you know, more shelf stable baked goods. We authorize beverages. They're capped at 5 milligrams THC versus 10 milligrams THC. But, you know, we hope to see real expansion in that category. As of December 7th, edibles represented 14% of the market, which is a little low compared to more mature markets. So we expect to see that rise over the next year as these products come to market.
Yeah. And I'm always super fascinated about the beverages end of the market. It's always one of those things where I've been like, people are so used to consuming beverages for alcohol. It's weird that they're not a bigger part of the market in cannabis, but putting that aside. So one fun question and then a couple follow-up serious questions about like terps and process controls. But I have a very important question and I'll explain why. So is smoked salmon shelf stable? And the reason I'm asking is because we're talking about New Jersey. And so as a Jersey boy who has moved to Colorado with many people in my family, my amazing stepbrother, Josh, who I loved tremendously, has opened a bagel place in Colorado called Rosenberg's Bagels. It is the only legitimate bagel place in the great state of Colorado. Comes, you know, 100-plus-year-old bagel recipe from a place that we grew up outside in Westwood, New Jersey, and like does the whole thing. I mean, lox, whitefish, and thank God, because living without bagels is a life that's just not worth it. Having to do that when I was in college in Maryland, because there are not bagels in College Park, Maryland in 98, that's for sure. And so back when legalization first happened, and this is like a Googleable thing, my brother Josh created what we are pretty certain is the world's first ever marijuana-infused smoked salmon. And if you are going to be like in New Jersey, like would smoked salmon be shelf stable such that you could create marijuana-infused lox and give the Jews of New Jersey what they really want?
So,
you don't have to really answer it. I just couldn't.
Yeah, no. Well, I would say cannabis infused lox would not, because it requires refrigeration before you open it.
Fair enough. One day we will have cannabis.
No, I'll put that, and I will echo your sentiments about bagels. So and I am a huge fan of lox and whitefish salad. It's a weekly ritual. My trek, there's a kosher bagel place near my house, and I go there pretty much every Saturday. You know, pick up a dozen bagels, either a thing of whitefish salad or a thing of lox. And so I'm gonna have to take this one under consideration.
We'll talk offline about it. It's just one of those things. I just couldn't, you know, if we're talking about Germany, I can't not talk about bagels and pizza, because that's really, you know, people just don't understand the bagel issue when you move outside of the New York City area and you don't have access to real bagels and what it is that the people outside are like, why do you care so much about bagels? They're not that good. And it's like, that's because you've never had a real bagel. When you give them a real bagel, they're like, holy shit, what have I been eating my whole life? All right. That was fun. Thank you for entertaining me. I hope that was funny for everybody else.
Yeah.
When we were talking, you mentioned CGMP and trying to get there. So I know we're kind of coming short on time at the moment, but just really quickly, like, just talk for a minute about the idea of like process. You don't actually like, it's not totally normal, like really real world CGMP, but just the idea of like getting businesses in New Jersey ready for federal legalization by requiring process controls now, because it's coming.
Yeah. So, you know, as part of our manufacturing regulations, there's a number of regs that apply to not only like what you can and can't use in your products, but also to the processes. And so, like, you know, cannabis manufacturers have to have procedures to ensure quality control. You know, they have to do things to maintain product integrity, make sure that their products have the strength that they're advertised as. And this goes beyond just kind of the third party testing that happens at the end of the line. This is supposed to happen throughout the entire process. And in the edible regulations that are going through the proposal process, they actually reference federal GMP regs, because, you know, that's ultimately where cannabis has to get. I think you noted, you know, rightfully so, that when federal, and I think it's a part of some of the bill drafts that are out there.
Every federal legalization bill I've ever seen has said, you guys got to do CGMP.
Right.
I've not seen one yet without it.
It's coming. And, you know, I think it's good not only to prepare businesses, but it's good for the end consumer, too, because, you know, businesses are not only relying on that sort of third party testing that happens at the end of the process, but they're, you know, they have a manufacturing supervisor. They have quality control processes. They have quality assurance processes. You know, these are all pieces of the overall manufacturing business that they have to establish.
There's a reason all the consumable things you've consumed all the time have to go through this, right? Like, it's not, you know, it is a good thing. It's definitely good for consumers. All right, I'm going to ask you three questions, pick one, and then we're going to wrap and we'll talk about the other ones down the line. Do you want to talk about terpenes and vapes? Do you want to talk about labeling requirements or tax structures? Dealer's choice.
Let's go terpenes and vapes.
Okay. We'll pause on the other one and we'll have you come back in 2024. We'll get into the other ones.
Yeah. So, you know, when we were the other piece to our manufacturing regulations really evolved out of our response to vaping related lung injury EVALI, and a lot of research that we did following that on how we could protect consumers. And I think every state, legal cannabis state and others, you know, looked at this. You know, obviously vitamin E acetate turned out to be a very problematic, harmful additive. But, you know, it really changed the focus to look at everything that's going into vape specifically and what may be harmful. And so we started doing a review of not only, you know, obviously vitamin E acetate was bad and a no-go, but, you know, some of the other additives that we saw in vapes as well. And one of the things that we saw right after EVALI was that, you know, some of the diluents were being taken out of vapes, but they were just being replaced by an increase in terpene potency. And, you know, terpene potency in the naturally occurring plant, I guess, you know, ranges anywhere from, you know, less than 1% to maybe, you know, 4%. I've talked to growers who say that, you know, in some hemp strains, they can get as high as 8 or so. But, you know, we capped what can be added to vapes at, you know, it's kind of the upper, very upper end of what you could possibly find in the naturally recurring plant, which is, I think it's either 8 or 10% we set it at. One of the reasons we did is there's studies that show when you heat terpenes to very high temperatures, they can break down into potentially harmful chemicals. They can, you know, really be irritants to the throat and esophagus. And so that was a concern for us. And we also capped the, so if a cannabis retailer is selling vape equipment, they can't, it can't heat past 500 degrees Fahrenheit for that same reason. So, you know, there's certain, I guess, you know, technical term would be dab rigs, that, you're not going to be able to purchase in New Jersey retailers because, they would heat past that 500 degree mark.
That's super interesting. I didn't even know about the temperature controls, but that's a really good point, right? And it's a very unique aspect of cannabis and the plant itself, right? When you think about, you know, non-cannabis vaporizers, it's all tobacco, but that's not really terpenes and flavor. Like, that's not what you're thinking about. But in cannabis, you can't ban flavoring. You can't ban terpenes because it's in the plant, right? Like, so you extract it out, but you want to say, hey, wait a minute. But if you start really heavy loading this and in levels well beyond you'd ever find in a natural plant, you can actually like create greater risk, right? And I always think about like assumption of risk. Like the consumer, if you want to consume cannabis, like the really real is if you want to consume cannabis, you are assuming risk. You're doing something that's a drug. That's fine. And there, you know, if you want to smoke something or vape something, like every doctor will tell you, like, that's not good for you. But, you know, in America, adults should be able to do what they want as long as they, you know, don't hurt their neighbors and pay their taxes and take care of their kids. And so you can choose to do something that's unhealthy. But if you're consuming cannabis, you are assuming the risk associated with the cannabis consumption, which could include the consequences of consuming heated terpenes through your lungs. But when you take a vape and you kind of elevate those terpenes well beyond what you'd find in a natural plant, you might be kind of going above and beyond the natural assumed risk assumption that a consumer would have. And that's a great way to balance it and say, hey, we're not saying you can't do this. We're not saying you can't even create a distillate and recombination into different flavors and things like that, which we'll put aside whether that's a good idea or not for another time. But you are saying you can't just like blow it out so that the consumer is kind of engaging in risky behavior beyond what they kind of knowingly would assume, right? So you're kind of striking that perfect balance of you can do something unhealthy if you want because you're an adult and that's what adults can choose to do. But you're going to assume the risk that you think you're assuming, not an enhanced one based on something that like, I mean, what percentage of Americans know that when you heat terpenes up to certain levels, they call blood? Like we're at a level of like, you have to be the nerdiest of nerds. You have to be the kind of person who would listen to this podcast and or come on as a guest to understand even what we're talking about now. Like, I don't even know if my wife would understand this stuff and she's got to listen to me all the time. So I think it's really cool to be able to strike that balance and kind of not overly restrict the industry, but at the same time, create consumer protections that are in line with the risks that they expect that they're assuming.
And on that, you know, with terpenes specifically, it's something that, you know, for cannabis, you know, connoisseurs, they're looking for, you know, a unique terpene profile. And so, you know, we thought, you know, I thought certainly, and a regulatory officer in talking about this, like, you know, people, to your point, are probably unaware that terpenes can be potentially harmful in some circumstances, you know, if they're in high concentrations or if they're heated to very high temperatures.
Do they even know what a terpene is? Like, because to be fair, before I was like a weed nerd before I was doing weed nerd shit for a living, but I didn't know what a terpene was when I was just like a high school kid in New Jersey doing things that I probably wasn't supposed to do under the law at the time, way back in the day. Like it wasn't until like I started doing this and people were like, well, terpenes, that's where the flavor and the aromas come from. And there's all these different compounds. And I was like, okay, well, welcome to a new level of weed nerd. Like I'm getting way deeper. So yeah, I think it's great, right? Cause consumers should just be able to like, sometimes it's okay to just like ignorance is bliss. Like sometimes it's just okay. You don't have to know, oh, that terpenes are what, like, you just want to like get home from work and like, you know, do all the things you need to do and like take care of your responsibilities and sit on the couch and smoke a joint. And it should be just as simple as that. And just like if you want to eat a cheeseburger, you should be able to assume that, yeah, you probably shouldn't eat cheeseburgers all the time and you probably shouldn't smoke weed all the time. But I can reasonably assume that I'm not getting enhanced risk from eating my cheeseburger. Like I'm taking on the risk of like, yeah, it's not good for me and I might gain some weight and it's not good for my heart and everything else. Just like I'm going to smoke cannabis, it's probably not good for me. But I'm assuming the risk that a general human being would have knowledge of, right? And this is a great way to kind of really, really technically, in the most like technical nerdy way, like ensure that that balance is being struck.
Exactly.
Awesome. Well, we are way too close to 5 o'clock on a Friday for you to be stuck talking to me. I'm sure you've got some stuff to do to wrap up your week and then do the actual job of your life, which is go be a dad. This is just the job that gets you to your next job with all of us. And that's how I like to think about my life. So, Jeff, I'll just say thank you absolutely so much for coming on the podcast. This has been the thrill of my week and just so much fun. So I really appreciate you taking the time.
Well, it was a pleasure. And likewise, I love getting to nerd out on this stuff. Even in my position, I don't get to do it often enough. And so, really welcome the opportunity. Thank you for having me on and look forward to talking again in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. Can't wait. So with that, we'll just say stay nerdy, everybody.